Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper, a host of the Public Policy Channel, and today we welcome Josephine Ensign, who joins us to talk about her new book, Skid Road, On the Frontier of Health and Homelessness in an American City, from Johns Hopkins University Press. Josephine, if you would, start us off by telling us a bit about yourself and how you came to write this book.
And thanks for having me, Stephen. So I am a public health nurse, which makes it a very interesting time to be a public health nurse. And I've been one for about 40 years, mostly working with people marginalized by poverty and homelessness. And my doctorate is in global health and health policy. I'm a professor of nursing at the University of Washington School of Nursing here in Seattle, and I teach health policy, public health, and health humanities. My scholarship, again, as well as my practice as a nurse and a nurse practitioner, has focused on health and social inequities, mostly in the United States, but also internationally. And Skid Road is my third book, my second book published by an academic press. And it's the culmination of what I kind of tongue-in-cheek call my trilogy of homelessness. My first book, Catching Homelessness, is a medical memoir about my work with and then my own experience with homelessness as a young adult in my hometown of Richmond, Virginia. And my second book, Soul Stories, has to do much more with trauma-informed care and homelessness and has a lot to do with gender-based violence. And then this third book is really more the history of health and homelessness in my hometown now of Seattle. So I've been a Seattle resident for close to 30 years and have worked with homeless youth, but also across the lifespan with people experiencing homelessness. In Seattle, I was drawn to Seattle because of its progressive politics and a good place to, at that point, being a single mom to raise my son, and have always been struck with kind of the irony or the juxtaposition between how progressive, kind of a hopeful city Seattle is, and also a very wealthy city now. With the fact that we have at least the third highest rate of homelessness in our country, and on a per capita basis, and especially with unhoused homelessness, probably have the worst situation for homelessness in our country. So I started to explore and question why that is, how we got to where we are now, and doing research, ethnography, oral history interviews with people working and living at the intersection of health and homelessness, and archive research to look into it.
Great. So I want to return us to that question you pose here and in the beginning of the book itself about how it is that we account for the fact that New York, Los Angeles, Seattle, we could throw San Francisco into the mix, these supposedly liberal progressive cities wind up also having the highest rates of people who are experiencing homelessness. But before we do that, I want to dig into a little bit of that much longer history of homelessness in Seattle that you recount in the book, and perhaps maybe use that as a way for you to lead us into a discussion about what you think has changed and what has not. So why don't we start with Edward Moore. Tell us a little bit about Edward Moore and who he was and what we should know about him and his life.
Yes. So Edward Moore, I feel as if I got to know as much as possible, at least for someone who's been deceased for many years. Edward Moore was found half frozen on a Seattle beach, the area that's now Belltown area of Seattle, in late December of 1854, and we know that he was a 32-year-old sailor, originally from Worcester County, Massachusetts. And whether he was shipwrecked or left here by a ship's captain, we don't really know. But he was found half frozen on the beach during a very cold winter by the townsfolk. It was Seattle was only about two years old at that time. And he had severe frostbite of his feet. We know that the town's main physician, Doc Maynard, amputated his toes with an axe, and then he was cared for after a fashion by Doc Maynard and his second wife, Catherine, who served as a nurse, and by various townsfolk. And he was Seattle's, from what I could tell in terms of the research, Seattle's first official homeless pauper and insane pauper. The Washington Territorial Poor Laws had just been passed that May and made it the role of the counties to take care of any paupers that fell ill within their jurisdiction, if their families could not be found. And of course, Edward's family was all back in Massachusetts. He was sent to Steilacoom, which was the main fort. It's just south of Seattle, taken care of by another physician who declared him insane. He was shackled there. They tried to, between King County physicians and then this other physician, Dr. Burns in Steilacoom, tried to be reimbursed for the cost of his care from the Washington Territorial Legislature. And the bill was more than the entire territory took in for the year. So he was sent back to King County, and finally the townsfolk took up kind of a contributions and bought Edward more kind of a full set of clothes, and also paid for a ship's captain to sail him back to Boston and then back to his hometown in Worcester County. And that's as far as most of the historians, kind of the official historians for Seattle, including Murray Morgan, said that was the last thing that we knew about him. And I was able to, after several years of trying, was able to track down what happened to him because of a librarian. I love librarians, a librarian in Worcester, Massachusetts, who found his death notice. And so piecing together what happened to him, he was shipped back to, through Boston, obviously, back to Worcester County, Massachusetts in 1856. And then his death was May 12th, 1859. In Ashburnham, Massachusetts, where his sister and his father and mother were living. It was an old mill town, and the cause of death was suicide by hanging cause insanity as the official death register. So just thinking about what most likely happened to him and what his most likely diagnosis was, there was never any indication that he was an alcoholic. And just looking at what's available within the official records and letters, from different people in Seattle, that he most likely was suffering from schizophrenia, as well as probably what we now call PTSD. And, you know, he was sent back to his family to be taken care of, and ended up killing himself. So just piecing together what happened there, what the role of government was and is, the poor laws that, obviously still exist in our different states, and the legacy of that, of thinking about, what some of the similarities are for how kind of the nascent town of Seattle and the townsfolk getting together, and not just the moral duty, but also the actual legal duty to take care of someone who obviously could not take care of himself, and then was obviously physically disabled after the amputations from the frostbite. And so just looking at that and realizing also as a nurse practitioner working with so many, thousands of people over the years, we don't always know the outcomes for people that we work with or that we deal with, in social services and health services, and trying, again, to piece together, well, what are the trajectories for people who we work with, and what things could we do differently that would have a better outcome for people affected by all of the different things that can contribute to homelessness.
Let me ask you if you would to share another of those very early stories that you recount in the book. Who is Princess Angeline?
Princess Angeline, yes. So Princess Angeline, Kikasomlo, is her Duwamish name, was the daughter of Chief South, or Chief Seattle, who was the chief of the Duwamish tribe at the time of the founding of the what was the settlement then of Seattle, and her story again, she was made into this this kind of for that time a media celebrity. She lived a long life, at least into her 80s, and also was homeless and a victim of domestic violence. And so piecing together her story of what's not necessarily in the official, again, and mostly told by white people, story of Princess Angeline. And so looking at that, getting into, again, the very early roots of gender-based violence and also sexual abuse and prostitution for Seattle, which is still with us today, including for young teens. And so looking at that, the roots of how we treat other people, the othering, how we, especially indigenous populations, the Duwamish tribe, still does not have official federal recognition. They're trying for that, and Seattle is built on their traditional ancestral lands. And Princess Angeline ended up living in and then dying in a one-room rough-hewn shack, which was located again in the Belltown area, right downhill of what is now Pike Place Market. In Seattle, and she died of tuberculosis in the one-room shack. And looking at that, even in terms of our modern-day tiny house villages, which Seattle has qu- quite a lot of, and is currently, you know, under our current mayor, it has been increased pretty dramatically, especially during the pandemic. And so looking at that, the roots of that, the roots of prostitution, and how that is a vast majority for young girls, not exclusively girls and women, but fairly high number that are obviously gendered female, and how many of them are from impoverished backgrounds, backgrounds that have included really severe sexual abuse that has not been adequately addressed, and also young girls and women of color, and looking at that for what's currently going on in Seattle.
So why don't we're gonna let's jump over a century's worth of interesting stories and rich history that you recount in the book, and why don't we come a little bit more up to the contemporary period? Let's just talk a little bit about what often we think of as sort of the period of modern homelessness, right? Beginning in the 1970s, 1980s. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on in Seattle in that period? And then we will, after that, jump forward and talk about the present, and then maybe conclude about what you think we can do about. So what's going on in the 70s and 80s in that period in Seattle?
Yeah, we can talk about the president too. Yes. So, and this is, you know, the modern period, or the big wave of contemporary homelessness is within my lifespan, and also within the time period that I have worked with homelessness. So that was interesting for me because I mostly had experienced it and knew about it in Boston and along the Eastern Seaboard where I lived and worked. But to look at what was happening with that in Seattle, and again, Seattle, because of its being a port town, being close to a border, a major border with Canada, and it's kind of its history. We have had a really big problem all along, again, with prostitution and with especially among street-involved young people. And so that I chose to focus that chapter on especially the 70s and 80s and then into the early 90s with street-involved young people who were at that point hanging out down near Pike Place Market and very much involved in prostitution. And then it obviously overlapped with the Green River killer and what was going on with that. He mostly preyed on the young teens who were living on the streets and who were involved with the sex trade, and he would pick them up and then murder them. So I was looking at that, what was going on with the kind of chronic alcoholics, what we had considered to be the main denizens of Skid Road, and how that was then changing to include much younger. Teens, young adults, and then also homeless families. I mean, that's the big thing that happened nationally at the time, and that was also happening here in Seattle, is that entire families were ending up homeless and struggling with finding places to stay. And in Seattle, again, similar to what was happening nationally, the SROs, the single room occupancy hotels, which had been kind of a place of last resort for people kind of falling, spiraling into poverty and homelessness or near homelessness. And those were being closed because of fire issues, and the city was beginning to be gentrified. So looking at the housing issues that were going on for people, as well as like failures in our child care system, foster care system, and then the arrival of different kinds of substances on the streets as well, and what was and how that was impacting people.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So let's work our way up to the present. What should people know about how many people are experiencing homelessness in Seattle today and what that life is like for them, recognizing obviously that it's different for different people in different circumstances, and what is and is not being done in order to help them?
Okay, so Seattle participates in the point in time count, as do other major municipalities.
It's just hard to say as president, isn't it?
There we go. There are other cities across the nation who get federal funding support for housing and homelessness issues. We were not able to do the full point and count time during the pandemic. So the current numbers are actually not known. The last actual point in time count that we were able to do right before the pandemic hit in January of 2020, and I participated as kind of like one of the leaders in the university district area near where I work and live, and that was hovering right over 12,000 people who were homeless in King County and around 4,000 in Seattle. And that has been pretty consistent between the years of 2017 and 2020. There was a slight dip in 2019, but also kind of a change in the methodology that makes the comparison a little bit different. And looking at the kind of the subgroups of people experiencing homelessness, the only two groups in 2020 that were showing kind of a consistent dip, reduction in homelessness were homeless youth, unaccompanied minors, and also veterans. And we know that obviously there's been a concerted effort across the country in terms of adequately addressing homelessness for veterans, and that has been the case also here in Seattle. So that probably contributes to that dip, and then also some changes in kind of foster care kinds of things, some really good programs for addressing homelessness among our teens and young adults across the state as well as in Seattle that hopefully contributed to the dip in youth homelessness. Unfortunately, especially for homeless families, a fairly significant increase despite kind of a regional approach that Gates Foundation funding to address family homelessness. But what they found, and that was changing from a housing readiness model, which we've had for a long time, kind of transitional housing, to getting families as quickly as possible, rapidly rehoused. And that's been really effective. But what they found, Not surprisingly, is that if you don't also address the incoming what newly homeless families, then it doesn't help. You have to have both of those efforts going on. And so that's something that's going on definitely during the pandemic. And again, we don't have good numbers on this, but the unhoused, the unsheltered homeless population has increased dramatically. And that's no surprise. A lot of the congregate shelters, just like throughout the country, had to close or at least greatly reduce capacity for the pandemic. And of course, the Seattle area was the first in our country to recognize that there was community spread of COVID. And so the number of people, the number of encampments everywhere, including like right next to my house, has increased, as well as vehicle residents, people living in cars and trucks and in our city parks, and side streets and everywhere else. So that definitely everybody is recognizing that population of unsheltered has dramatically increased. The city and the county have finally begun to work together on hopefully a concerted regional response to homelessness. We now have a King County Authority on Homelessness. And the executive director for that was just hired and is just started. I do find it hopeful. They are a person of color and also someone who has experienced homelessness in their past. So I find that to be two hopeful kinds of steps in the right direction. And Seattle itself has really tried to, again, start because of the pandemic, being spurred on to buy up hotels and motels, to work with Harborview Medical Center. That's like our main King County Safety Net Hospital, as well as Public Health Seattle King County Healthcare for the Homeless Program, to have nurses and other medical people on site for kind of a quarantine and recovery center for people who don't have adequate housing to quarantine and recover from COVID, and of looking at expanding that because it's really helped people, not surprisingly, again, to become more stable and to then get right into more long-term housing. And so that's been expanding, and also as I mentioned, the kind of the tiny house villages, and of increasing those, which again is controversial because most tiny house villages, at least in Seattle, don't have their own bathrooms. It's like a kind of a congregate bathroom kind of area and shared kitchen tent area. So it's better than being probably in an encampment or in a vehicle somewhere for some people, but it's not, from my perspective, it's not real housing. It's not a long-term solution to homelessness.
So let's say that I am an unhoused single man in Seattle today with an undiagnosed and untreated mental illness. Am I better off than Edward Moore was?
Oh my goodness, yes. I talk about that in my book. I go through the history of, especially for Washington State, Washington Territory, and then state of our history in terms of treatment for people with mental illness. We have currently one of the country's highest rates of pretty severe mental illness, and we have one of the worst mental health systems. And they're again, has been recognition of that and a lot of effort being put into addressing it. So that's for housed people as well as people experiencing homelessness. I think that an Edward Moore today, I mean, one of the things that I talk about, you know, that's been developed in Seattle, we have, you know, we were some of the pioneers of the Medic One system, working through, again, Harborview Medical Center with our fire fighters and having medics who respond, you know, to emergencies and really help people get to the right place and to survive in the field. So they would probably have been involved with a modern day, and I know they are involved with modern day Edward Moores, and again, mostly relying on Harborview Medical Center as kind of the hospital of last resort to help people get the help that they need. And Harborview has gotten an infusion of funding from the state to increase their capacity in terms of mental health treatment, both kind of emergency triage and then inpatient care and aftercare. You know, currently, Harborview Medical Center, I think they're licensed for something like 419 beds, inpatient beds, and they're over 500 as of today. A lot of that because of the, again, the fifth wave or whatever we're on now with COVID, but also a lack of places and staffing at more long-term facilities to be able to have people be discharged to who are ready to be discharged. So that, yeah, obviously it's been complicated dramatically because of the pandemic. But I do see hopeful signs of more kind of coordinated care to help people who are dealing with mental illness. And we do recognize, obviously, I think we all intuitively know this, that having safe, stable housing is itself a very potent form of mental health treatment. Even people who aren't getting therapy, aren't getting, you know, whatever appropriate medications, psychotropic medications they might need, having a safe and stable, affordable place to stay dramatically increases people's mental health. As long as there's obviously also kind of a community so that they're not suffering loneliness within that. So I think that there are lots of people and programs and agencies throughout Seattle that are really working to address this, not only for the single male like Edward Moore suffering from mental illness, but also families and teens and young adults and the elderly as well, because we know that we have a significant aging population of people who have chronically been homeless.
So Josephine, why don't we conclude by going back to where we began in the question that you raised first. All that having been said, why is it that when we look at Seattle, Los Angeles, New York, San Francisco, that we seem to have the largest number of people experiencing homelessness in these places that are supposedly liberal or progressive?
Yes, that is interesting. I get some not so nice questions with the same kind of thing from people, from trolls on social media. So thanks for asking it more nicely. You know, it's all people.
Well, it's a bit of a puzzle, right?
Yeah, it is. And I think personally that many people are attracted to places like Seattle that are more progressive. These are also, you know, obviously areas with jobs, with higher standards of living, also high cost of living. And people are attracted here, whether or not they were homeless to begin with in whatever place, like an outlying area of Washington State. We know that the vast majority of people who are homeless in Seattle and King County are from the region, from the state, before they became homeless. But, you know, I've had many patients who have moved here with the promise of a job at Microsoft or, you know, one of the different startups. And then that job dried up when they got here and they had used all of their savings and, you know, the grace of their families to move here, and they spiral into homelessness. So that definitely happens. The cost of housing in all of these areas, and especially Seattle, especially during the pandemic, has led the country in terms of just the massive rise of the cost of housing. It's getting out of reach even for, you know, supposedly middle-class families. And then, you know, the eviction moratorium and then all of the kinds of things in terms of that beginning to expire. That, you know, we do know that more people are falling into homelessness, like for the first time in their lives, and many more people are at risk of that if we don't do something to address that. So I think it's because we're vibrant. We happen to be progressive, but also vibrant communities. Seattle does have like some of the highest opportunity areas for, you know, again, for children born into poverty being able to move out of poverty by the time they're a young adult.
Super high upward mobility rates.
Yeah, which is amazing. And those are, and again, those are not, this is Chetty and the researchers mostly mm-hmm. from Harvard. And it's not necessarily rich zip codes. You know, there are zip codes that, you know, just a real kind of range of income levels, but they manage somehow to do it right in terms of, you know, the quality of their public schools, the community kind of cohesion. That's a super important thing, especially for children, but also for all of us. And I think people, even if they don't know the research behind that, I think word of mouth, you know, that attracts mm-hmm. people. And then people can experience, again, different kinds of crises, trauma that precedes them going into homelessness, and then the trauma that accompanies homelessness, which, you know, just makes it that much more difficult to successfully exit homelessness. So that's why I think a lot of the places like, again, San Francisco and Seattle have really high rates of homelessness, especially unsheltered homelessness. Because, of course, New York has a mandate for a right to shelter. Plus, it's usually colder, not as easy to survive outside.
You're listening to the New Books Network, and we have been speaking today with Josephine Ensign, who has been talking about her new book, Skid Road, On the Frontier of Health and Homelessness in an American City, new out from Johns Hopkins University Press. Josephine, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us and share a little bit of the work that you did in your book.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you for the opportunity.